Welcome to The Word from Porter Street, the podcast in which I, Chris Phillips, report on my teaching, research, and whatever else might occur to me to talk about. In this April 21st installment, I'd like to go all the way back to the beginning of March to talk about the Society of Early Americanists conference, which happened in Philadelphia the first week of March. One of the things that fascinated and surprised me about the conference was that it seemed everybody was talking about religion at some time or another. I, of course, was talking about religion throughout the conference. The very first session, I was chairing a panel that I'd put together on different materials and methods involved in the study of religion in early America. It was a panel that involved archaeology, literary studies, social history, a fantastic range of disciplines, and we had some excellent conversation from that. I also presented on a panel that was dealing with sentimentalism, ideology, OB religion, just about any angle, it seemed, that you could talk about religion among a group of four papers. My particular paper was on the first printings of Isaac Watts's hymns in North America, and it turns out that this was done by Cotton Mather. It seemed appropriate enough because Isaac Watts is the second most published author in North America in the 18th century. The first most published author is Cotton Mather. Mather was a correspondent of Watts's and was also very interested in bringing hymns into popular culture in America, this at a time when all you would have sung in Protestant churches were psalms. And Mather was not interested in bringing the hymns into church services per se, but as private devotions, he thought that this could be an antidote to a number of evils he saw at the time, particularly people's penchants for singing sinful ballads. The first time that Mather used Watts's hymns in one of his publications was in A Guide for Family Prayer in 1709, and he included these to be used as read prayers, not as sung prayers. In his later printings, he never printed an edition of Watts's hymns by itself. He always included them as appendices to something else, this prayer guide which went through several editions, more frequently into his sermon pamphlets, as he would preach a sermon that seemed to strike a chord with his listeners, he would arrange to have it published. And sometimes, by an accident of printing, if you try to take up an entire sheet of paper, say you want to fill 24 pages to fill a sheet, and you only get 22 pages of type out of a sermon, sometimes Mather did go a little bit shorter than he expected, he would have these blank pages, and he would stick Watts hymns in those places. That would, of course, be thematically tied to his sermons, something he couldn't do with psalms in a church service, because the psalms were sung in course. You started at a certain point of the year singing Psalm 1, and you went straight through to Psalm 150, and then you started over again. So these sermon pamphlets provided what I argued was an alternative liturgical space for Mather, where he could use poetry to reinforce what he was getting at in prose. And it turned out that this was a very popular way for other clergy to use Watts at this time as well, following Mather's lead. And in fact, at the only point where it seems that Watts's hymns start to gain ascendancy, during the Great Awakening in the early 1740s, this is actually the moment when the pastor's power is first being decisively challenged in New England. And so Watts leads to both the rise of pastoral textual authority, or maybe the consolidation, rather, of pastoral textual authority in Mather's time in the very early 1700s. But by the time we get to Jonathan Edwards' time in the 1740s, Watts is actually being used to undermine pastors. It's putting power in the hands of the congregation, in the hands of the people. And in Edwards' case, his congregation, while Edwards was away preaching a revival sermon at another church, decided that they would throw out their old psalters and switch to Watts's hymns without consulting him. He actually liked Watts's hymns a great deal, but he was very concerned that the congregation would do this without him giving the authorization. In less than 10 years, things would get so tense between Edwards and his congregants that he would actually be voted out of the pulpit by his congregation in 1750. So this study is taking me into religious history, it's taking me into the history of denominations, but also into the history of the book and how these printings were produced. I'm getting interested in what booksellers were involved in this and what they did with these hymns as they produced them, who authorized some of these printings. There is one early printing of Watts's hymns for children in New England. It's the first single author presentation of Watts as a poet in North America. And it's not clear who authorized or paid for the printing. It's only known that it's sold at a bookseller's who worked a lot with Cotton Mather, so Mather may have been involved, he may not. There's no documentary evidence, but these kinds of mysteries are what I'm going to be working on this summer as I continue to expand this work, as well as some other projects I'll talk about later. What I'd like to do now is to wrap up this installment by reading from a new collection by Kimiko Han, who is the judge for the McKnight Black Poetry Contest at Lafayette this spring. Kimiko Han teaches at Queens College in New York, and her most recent collection from Norton is titled Toxic Flora. It's a series of poems inspired by science articles from the New York Times. And I'm going to read from the marine biology section. There's a section on insects, section on plants, section on astronomy. I'm going to read from the marine biology section. A poem called Brooding. For N. Misinformation lasts millennia, as when a student hauling a trawl bucket from the black midwaters off Monterey found a mass of squid eggs with the mother beside them. Surely a coincidence, since female squids abandon their eggs. Then, a year later, another bucket produced the same, this time hatchlings, though general disbelief continued. So the scientist lowered a robot with camera and lights and spied a female cradling several thousand eggs, waving her tentacles to aerate and nourish. Misconceptions about squid arise because the deep is so poorly explored, that one might substitute one's own fear for hard evidence. My own daughters declare, "If you'd been around more, we would have gone mad," which is somehow comforting. Cuttlefish are next under scrutiny. Well, thank you for listening to this installment. Feel free to post a comment to my website, and until next time, may you find good words and delight in the words that find you.